Lecture 12, The Thomistic Synthesis. Our subject in this lecture is Thomas Aquinas and natural law. Aquinas is perhaps the single greatest exponent and theorist of natural law, and hence is given a complete lecture here. He is a man of the 13th century, a Dominican priest, who is particularly responsible for the renewal of Catholic theology, Catholic theological thinking, in a way that put it on a very different course, gave it different reasons for holding some of the same positions that it always held. And he gives his account of natural law within a book called the Summa Theologiae, the Summa of Theology. It occupies only one small portion of that, but it is a very complete and demanding treatise on the natural law, and I will like to spend the balance of our lecture on that. For the purpose of giving an adequate account, though, of his thought, I'll divide today's lecture into three parts, namely, first, a bit of a segment on Thomas Aquinas' life and why it is that he is so known for this recovery of natural law. Secondly, a short segment on what he understood about law and about morality in general so that we can see where natural law fits into his system. And thirdly, some remarks about natural law as such. Aquinas was a Dominican theologian. The Dominicans are one particular order within the church, and they were founded just one generation before by Saint Dominic. Thomas Aquinas taught in the papal courts that sat in various places in Italy, and not only Rome, but Viterbo and Orvieto, as well as teaching at the University of Naples and at the University of Paris. What particularly distinguished him was the way in which he incorporated the thought of Aristotle into Catholic theology. Up until his time, the most prominent strain of Catholic theology in the West is the strain that follows Augustine, who is relatively Platonic in his philosophical commitments. I think all of Christianity, led by Augustine, but much of the patristic period and the early portion of the Middle Ages, was so highly appreciative of Plato, more so than of Aristotle, precisely because Plato seemed to be a person who defended things like the immortality of the soul, where you weren't at all sure that Aristotle would have agreed with that. Likewise, there are places in the works of Plato where he seems to encountenance a creator of the world. It isn't quite the creator of the world the Genesis envisions, but it's close enough. And so they envisaged Plato as someone who was almost a Christian. And the lines that most of the theological development followed were Augustinian. It's a certain pessimism about human nature and its possibilities unless aided by grace. But what happened in the late 12th century and the early 13th century was a recovery of the texts of Aristotle. The thought of Aristotle had been almost forgotten, with the exception of his works in logic. The works in logic were known continuously and were the subject of much fruitful reflection in philosophy and theology. The name of Aristotle and some of his positions were known, for example, his thoughts on justice, who I think were always clear, but they literally did not have the text. They did not know exactly what it was that he had written and did not have a text available to consult. The source of the recovery of Aristotelian text, curiously, is Christianity's contact with Islam. The various Muslim theologians, Muslim philosophers, had known of Aristotle more continuously. They were still available. And when, especially in Spain, there was contact between Christian West and Islamic theorists, the texts of Aristotle were translated from Greek into Islamic into Latin. And then, once the discovery of Aristotle began and they saw how tremendously powerful these were for natural science especially, the Christians began to translate directly from the Greek, bypassing the Islamic route, and there were schools of translators. But when Aristotle's texts began to be known, they weren't universally appreciated. In fact, it was thought that this was very dangerous, that the Aristotelian schools, and especially his Islamic commentators, people like Averroes, seemed to be holding views that were antithetical to Christian teaching. For example, on whether there is an immortal soul, or on whether the world is eternal rather than created. And so Aristotle was thought of as rather dangerous, and his Islamic interpreters all the more dangerous. Thomas Aquinas, studying under Albert the Great, began to find ways in which, if you change Aristotle just slightly, you can make it not just acceptable to Christianity, but in fact make it an even better defense of certain very traditional Christian teachings than the Platonic Augustinian route. And that is what I think Thomas Aquinas is best known for in the history of philosophy, as it were, baptizing Aristotle. Now, in his own thought, making use of this Aristotle, we find avenues toward natural law. The general rubric under which so much of Thomistic philosophy and theology is done can be contained and suggested by this sentence. Grace, God's grace, does not destroy, but builds on nature. It's a thesis I think that Augustine would have been very uncomfortable with his strong sense of original sin, the ways in which our nature was corrupted, the ways in which our original integrity and innocence were cracked. Nature did not seem to be a very reliable base. It seemed to be a foundation that was extremely wounded and weak. This varies a little bit with how severe you read the wound that was received with Adam and how you take your Augustinianism, full dose or only partial strength. But there's a sense in which he's Augustinian thought is just extremely nervous about building on nature and suggesting instead that God's grace has to come and overwhelm you, much as it did in Augustine's own life, where he could not manage to persuade himself to do what it is that he knew with his intellect that he needed to do until grace overwhelmed him in that moment of conversion in the garden. What Aquinas finds in Aristotle is a way in which to appreciate nature much, much more. Still to think that we do need grace. Aquinas is still committed to the doctrine of original sin. He still has a sense that our minds have been darkened, that our wills have been weakened by original sin, let alone the history of sins individually and as they build up within a culture to cultural blindness. But he has got a better sense, a stronger, a more optimistic and hopeful sense of how much that nature can be relied upon. Even though nature won't be enough to save us, it can at least be a sufficient foundation upon which grace can come and grace can build. Hence, Aquinas regards grace building on nature. He regards it differently. It's not so much that grace has to come and overwhelm nature, but rather that grace will come and will enter into a person and will heal nature. It's very much a difference with respect to how you understand the way in which grace works and how you understand salvation when it comes. And Aquinas is emphasizing grace as healing this corrupted nature, but building on something that gives a sufficient foundation and a sufficient strength for that building. In this regard, Aquinas can have a much greater appreciation for the natural virtues. I quoted that line two lectures ago from Augustine, namely that virtue without faith is false virtue. And what he seemed to mean by that was no disrespect to the Romans, whom he so much admired, but rather a sense that there's something in any one of those natural virtues, prudence or courage or temperance or justice, that if undertaken without the grace of faith, could very well blind a person by pride. One would think that one can accomplish too much on one's own strength. Aquinas, building on Aristotle, will have a much healthier appreciation for those natural virtues and will simply put them in tandem, natural virtues and supernatural virtues, that in addition to prudence, courage, temperance, and justice, we'll also be talking about faith and hope and charity and other things like humility, and regarding these various supernatural virtues as building upon the basis that nature sets. Hence, to summarize, grace does not destroy, but rather perfects nature. Grace comes and heals what is wounded, but what is not mortally wounded. Now, in the course of his thinking, Aquinas is also extremely indebted to the canonists, those ecclesiastical lawyers whom we were discussing in the last lecture. The debt here is primarily by way of method. namely that the lawyers, as is still typical in law schools today, like to compare and contrast cases. They will take what this lawyer and this judge said about a case and what that lawyer and those jurists said about some other case and see that they're in conflict with one another and then try to find a resolution. Aquinas, reading Gratian and reading these other canon lawyers, makes this a new method for doing theology, that where an Augustine or theologians in the tradition of Augustine had tended to be scripture commentators, had tended to develop a theory of theology based especially on extremely ascetical practices that were typical of the monasteries, Aquinas has a great interest in commenting on texts, both the texts of Aristotle and the texts of Scripture, but he does it dialectically. He does it by setting up one opinion against another opinion and then trying to outdo the lawyers, not just to juxtapose these things and to take the solution which he prefers, but finding a way to reconcile them where possible. This is a general stance of his method, and it's the stance of scholastic method in general, and he is, in a way, the greatest of these scholastic figures, the philosophers who belong to the schools, to the newly emerging universities. In the course of making these distinctions, which are so crucial to progress when one is proceeding dialectically, we can examine how he does this with law. In an earlier lecture, I already commented on the fact that he did so, distinguishing between eternal law, namely God's providential plan for the whole universe, and the building in of natural systems and natural ends into each kind of being. Secondly, divine law, when God reveals explicitly what it is that he needs humankind to observe by way of morality. Third, natural law, in the sense of natural moral law, our reason's participation in the eternal law, using our own noggin to try to reflect upon our own nature and to articulate the demands of morality, imitating the divine providence in figuring out what will lead to real human fulfillment, and on the other hand, what would lead to human frustration. And finally, human law, or positive law, civil law, the kind of law that human legislatures make when they make constitutions or legislation or some kind of judicial review. Now, in making that distinction, Aquinas will be very, very dependent upon an Aristotelian sense of nature. That is, nature defined not as the birds, the bees, the fields, and the trees, but rather nature in the way that Aristotle and the philosophers in the tradition of Aristotle have been accustomed to understanding nature. Nature is that inner principle of a thing's growth, of a thing's development, of a thing's typical activity. And what Aquinas will do is to suggest reason has to reflect on that nature. It has to reflect on the structure of our bodies, but also the structure of our soul. And it has to reflect not just on the existing structures as they're found in the mature adult, but has to reflect upon the development of those structures from the incipient stage of a human life through its natural death. He has to look at the natural end-directedness, the teleological dynamism of our natures, precisely in order to share in this godlike project of using providence, of being far-sighted and foreseeing, looking to what it is that human nature really needs for the accomplishment of the end for which it's designed. Hence, Thomas, with a certain optimism that comes from this newly rediscovered Aristotle, thinks that we can participate in the divine project by reflecting on our natures, and even though those natures are wounded, they're not as innocent or as integral as perhaps the Greeks, perhaps Aristotle conceived them, that even though we've got wounded nature, even though we've got original sin as somehow a deficiency that we have to overcome, something that can distort our appreciation, nonetheless, there's enough solidity, there's enough of a basis for us really to know the natural law obligations that we have and to defend those natural law obligations to people of goodwill, and to show the things that are very typical of any natural law theory, namely the objectivity, the universality, and the intelligibility of these moral claims. Thomas has a strong theory of divine law as in conformity and cooperating with natural law. The divine law in Genesis, and especially in Exodus and Deuteronomy, the divine law, as it's revealed by Jesus in the Gospel, the divine law is that which can help confirm the natural law. That is, if we're trying by our reason to understand what it is we must do, God has said so, at least in certain respects. And in the places where the divine law makes something clear, one can see a confirmation of this natural reason. On the other hand, one will see a new avenue, a new opportunity for trying to reach moral decisions on those areas where the divine law has not made things explicit. If the divine law, showing that we were right in these areas of the natural law, where it became obvious that one should not arbitrarily take innocent life in murder, where one should not violate one's marital vows by any kind of adultery, where one should not remove property that does not belong to us, unless in those cases where the physical good has reverted to common ownership because of dire need. In those cases where the natural law has exhibited an obligation that the divine law has explicitly stated the same point, we have all the more reason to trust our reason. And we can now, with much greater confidence, with greater hope, with greater optimism than Augustine or the theology that followed from Augustine, we can trust reason for articulating a natural law where heretofore reason had been a little bit under suspicion as being insufficiently powerful, as being too darkened, or perhaps too much under the sway of those impotence of will that we had seen as a result of original sin. In the course of articulating his theory, Aquinas also has some important distinctions with respect to morality. Namely, I am anxious at showing Thomas Aquinas as a proponent of natural law, but I do not want to misrepresent him as holding that natural law constitutes the whole of morality. Rather, he places natural law within the Summa of Theology and within that section of the Summa of Theology that deals with morality, and he thinks that there are some other crucial aspects of morality. There is, for instance, the divine law, which makes things clear, which are otherwise not clear, but there are also huge matters of virtue. One can see all those natural virtues as rooted in our own strengths, rooted in our abilities to be just, be courageous, be temperate, be prudent, and that these make an enormous contribution toward the whole of morality. Notice that as soon as we start contrasting law with virtue, we've got a different take, we've got a different sense of what the project of morality is. When one is focusing on law and morality, one is focusing on the minimal standards, what everybody must do in order to be moral. When one is focusing on virtue, one is talking about excellence, on the ideals to which one should try to reach, one should try to obtain. This is a lovely combination. It's a suggestion that when we need to discipline the wrongdoers, we will use law and suggest they aren't even meeting minimal standards. But we shouldn't content ourselves with minimal standards. We should range up and seek excellence in the course of the virtues. Some of the virtues will be natural, but other virtues can only be obtained by divine grace, those supernatural virtues, and this too is a part of morality. Likewise, not everything is covered by law, and not everything is covered by virtue. Sometimes what one has to look at is human custom and moral suasion. That is, at some point in the course of morality, one must look at those things which one couldn't possibly enforce by law, gratitude, for example. But it isn't necessarily one of the classical virtues, and one must rather depend upon human training. One must depend upon elders. One must depend upon the wise in the community to point out what compromises need to be made for us to live together, and on the other hand, what sorts of things will be extremely beneficial to a community, ways to determine our common life that might not otherwise thought of or might not otherwise be developed. To summarize, then, Aquinas puts his notion of natural law within the context of a morality, of a sense of ethics that includes both a divine component with divine law and supernatural virtues, a natural law, but also natural virtues, moral suasion with a healthy dose of grace. Now, his own particular theory of natural law, he articulates it much as the lawyers do, and what he wants to tell us in that little treatise on natural law is that we need to make some distinctions between the levels of natural law. And as far as I know, he is the first theorist to set up the matter in this way. The first point is this, namely, that there is one natural law principle that is absolutely innate in us, that we cannot not know. And that first principle of the natural law is this: do the good and avoid the evil. Of course, it's so general that it doesn't help us much. What is good and what is evil in this particular case? And yet, he thinks of it as a very fundamental principle, in fact, a principle that is self-evident. That is, can you imagine anybody, if they ever got around to thinking about the subject, who thought that it would be a good idea to pursue the evil and to avoid the good? That is, nobody would be willing to accept that. It's a principle that is absolutely fundamental and will make it possible to have an ethical science, make it possible to have a series of deductions in the realm of ethics if we can reduce any other particular idea or any other particular moral claim to that fundamental status of do the good in this case and avoid the evil, then we've got an absolute fundamental case, an absolute fundamental principle that nobody will be in the position to deny. In the process of articulating that fundamental principle, do the good and avoid the evil, he is relying upon a certain point of moral psychology, namely that the way humans work is that we are automatically constructed in such a way that we'll automatically be attracted to the good. Think about it for a minute, if you will. When we find something attractive in life, whether it be good food at a restaurant, or whether it be a matter of pleasant people or beautiful faces, whether it be a matter of lovely paintings, lovely outdoors, if there's something good, we can't help but be attracted to it. Our freedom doesn't consist in being attracted. Where our freedom kicks in is whether or not we'll go along with that attraction, whether we'll exclude the other things that might be attractive and go with this particular good or that one. He roots his own sense of the first moral principle in the way we're made. We're made to be attracted toward goods. Where our freedom consists in is which good we'll go with, which particular option we'll select among the goods that are possible, or conversely, which evil we'll flee from. Secondly, he needs to specify this. And so at the second level of the natural law, in order to give us a little bit more helpful advice, what he proposes is that we try to realize our own natural potential. And in the course of describing this, he notices that there are three particular areas where we feel a natural inclination. That is, some of the inclinations that we naturally feel, some of the attractions to which we are naturally drawn, are things that we share with all beings. Others are going to be attractions that we share with all animals. And some are attractions that we experience only within the human community. He thinks that an analysis of these very diverse groups of natural attraction, natural inclination, will yield greater insight at the secondary level about our natural law obligations. Let's take each of those in turn. There are those inclinations which human beings share with all other creatures, the desire to continue in existence, the notion of ongoing life. He thinks that if we reflect on this, what we'll see is that life and existence are goods, and hence, you can eventually, by thinking about it, see that there is a natural law obligation that prohibits murder, that prohibits suicide, that prohibits mutilation. Or, if you want to put it positively, there's a command to do what is necessary in order to continue to exist and allow others to continue to exist. So he thinks that the first specification of the natural law comes when we reflect on those inclinations we have simply to continue to live. A second group of inclinations are things that we share with other animals. You can see here how he's using the Roman jurist Ulpian, who had been inclined to take natural law as something like the instinct in animals. He notices that all animals have a desire to grow, to reproduce, to use their powers of sensation, they're curious, to use their powers of locomotion. And he thinks that when we reflect on how that works in us, in human beings, that there's corresponding natural law obligation which can be drawn, namely an obligation to care for whatever offspring one has, a prohibition on doing anything which would imperil the propagation of the species, that there's something wrong with that which would prevent the species from going on, just as there's something very right with making sure that you do take care of whatever offspring you generate. Thirdly, he thinks that there are certain natural obligations that come from a third group of natural attractions or natural inclinations. Namely, we humans have an inclination to talk. Why, I've been doing it here for hour upon hour. And we all have that sense of a desire to communicate. Likewise, we have a desire to live in society. We have a desire to have friends and to be sociable. We have desires to choose things and to make various promises and commitments and to make various decisions. Well, he thinks, similarly, if you reflect upon those natural inclinations, and again, if you sort out what the good inclinations are from the bad inclinations, you have to have a lot of experience. Test this by history as well as by the experience of one's peers as well as one's own experience. When one tests these various inclinations, one will likewise find various moral obligations. If it's a matter of speech, for instance, he thinks that there's an obligation not to lie. Or if there's a matter of living together in community, he thinks there's an obligation never to offend those with whom we must live. It's one of those obligations that come precisely from our life in common. Since humans have such a long-standing dependence upon their parents and upon elders, he thinks that there's a natural law obligation that comes directly to honor one's elders, to whom one owes such a great debt of gratitude. Now, I've given these only by way of example, and his own texts, when you have the opportunity to look at them, go into far more examples of the various duties and the various prohibitions that he mentions. I do not present an exhaustive list, but rather simply a set by way of illustration and example. Even so, those things are fairly general. Let me take just one case that's a very frequent set of objections coming from it, namely the obligation that we have not to lie. But, of course, you've got to make further distinctions. And so not only is there a first level of natural law, do the good and avoid the evil, and a second level, namely, don't lie but tell the truth, but then you've got to go to the third level and start looking at the particular circumstances. Do you, for instance, need to tell all the truth you know about everything all the time? Of course not. I mean, there are things that are properly kept secret and other things that must be told. And then there's also questions about, need one tell everything to everybody when they ask? Well, no, some people do not have a right to the truth. One thinks about those proverbial stories of soldiers knocking on the door asking if you are harboring fugitives. And it's not necessary to tell the soldiers everything that they want, especially if what they're seeking is an unjust request, if they're seeking the life of someone who deserves protection. Hence, one shouldn't content oneself at the second level of natural law. One has to consider all sorts of factors about circumstances and the ways in which these questions arise at the third level in order to be sure one has correctly stated one's natural law obligation. Now, the discovery of these levels of natural law, primary level that are so general, always truthful and always known, but very, very general, and then a discovery of a secondary level of natural law, which gives us the main areas where we find natural law obligation, and finally a tertiary level when we really get down to the specifics of any given situation. For Aquinas, this is precisely good use of our reason, the reason that God gave us, reflecting upon our God-given nature. Namely, we have a tremendous talent which God gives us. He, too, has given us some level of detail in those Ten Commandments, some level of specificity, but he has still left a tremendous amount to us to try to figure out. This is one of, I think, Thomas Aquinas's greatest insights. It's the insight about where our freedom consists, what our freedom consists in this world. Remember, he had said about the human will that the human will is highly determined. It's determined to be attracted toward a good that we perceive. We can't help but feel the attraction of a beautiful face. We can't help but feel some attraction toward good food. We can't help but feel the attraction toward nice temperature or just a change in our surroundings. But we're not forced to choose any one of the goods that we do perceive as good. Now, if you will, do a little thought experiment with me. Bring God into the equation. What would happen if God himself were present before us? We would feel now an infinite attraction. It wouldn't be against our nature because it would be a genuine good. We would be spontaneously drawn toward that God, but we wouldn't have any particular way to exercise our freedom. We wouldn't have any of the options, any of the alternatives, any of the possibility of going otherwise. It wouldn't be against us, But on the other hand, we really wouldn't have any options left. What Aquinas thinks is that part of the mystery of God's plan is that God, in his own wonderful and complete divine self, is not present to us in this life, but that God remains in heaven. Aquinas thinks that he sent his son, but he sent his son in a human form, who did not appear to be God. He looked like a regular man. And it's precisely this distance, that God is not present to us in his fullness in this world, which keeps us free. Freedom is not a matter, for Aquinas, of choosing whatever we want. Freedom, rather, refers to our power to choose what we will. We can't help but be attracted to the finite goods of this life, but no finite good in this life overpowers us. Rather, we, at least in principle, are stronger than any finite good, and we can increase our willpower if our willpower has been a little weak, so that we can always say no to lots of possible goods. And yet there is a moral order, a moral hierarchy, of things that we ought to prefer, things that we ought to choose. For Thomas, this is the natural law, a set of directions and obligations about what we ought to choose, given that we are still free to choose as well as we can, and that we are responsible for what we choose.
We genuinely hope you've enjoyed these lectures from our Great Courses series. Our courses are now available to order online. Visit our website at www.teach12.com or call our customer service representatives at 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-832-2412. Thank you very much.